My mother announced that it was time to open presents. She always insisted I do this in front of everyone, which was a problem because, as I may have mentioned already, I'm not a good liar. That also means I'm not good at feigning gratitude for re-gifted CDs of country Christmas music or subscriptions to Field and Stream. For years, Uncle Les had labored under the baffling delusion that I'm outdoorsy. But for decorum's sake, I forced a smile and held up each unwrapped trinket for all to admire until the pile of presents left on the coffee table had shrunk to just three. I reached for the smallest one first. Inside was a key to my parents' four-year-old luxury sedan. They were getting a new one, my mom explained, so I was inheriting the old one. My first car. Everyone oohed and ahed, but I felt my face go hot. It was too much like showing off to accept such a lavish present in front of Ricky, whose car cost less than my monthly allowance at age 12. It seemed like my parents were always trying to get me to care about money, but I didn't, really. Then again, it's easy to say you don't care about money when you have plenty of it. The next present was the digital camera I'd begged my parents for all last summer. "Wow," I said, testing its weight in my hand. "This is awesome." "I'm outlining a new bird book," my dad said. "I was thinking maybe you could take the pictures." "A new book," my mom exclaimed. "That's a phenomenal idea, Frank. Speaking of which, whatever happened to that last book you were working on?" Clearly, she'd had a few glasses of wine.
"I'm still ironing out a few things," my dad replied quietly.
"Oh, I see," I could hear Uncle Bobby snickering.
"Okay," I said loudly, reaching for the last present. "This one's from Aunt Susie." "Actually," my aunt said as I began tearing away the wrapping paper, "it's from your grandfather." I stopped mid-tear. The room went dead quiet, people looking at Aunt Susie as if she'd invoked the name of some evil spirit. My dad's jaw tensed, and my mom shot back the last of her wine. "Just open it and you'll see," Aunt Susie said. I ripped away the rest of the wrapping paper to find an old hardback book, dog-eared and missing its dust jacket. It was The Selected Works of Ralph Waldo Emerson. I stared at it as if trying to read through the cover, unable to comprehend how it had come to occupy my now trembling hands. No one but Dr. Golan knew about the last words, and he'd promised on several occasions that unless I threatened to guzzle Drano or do a backflip off the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, everything we talked about in his office would be held in confidence. I looked at my aunt, a question on my face that I didn't quite know how to ask. She managed a weak smile and said, "I found it in your grandfather's desk when we were cleaning out the house. He wrote your name in the front. I think he meant for you to have it." God bless Aunt Susie. She had a heart after all. "Neat. I didn't know your grandpa was a reader," my mom said, trying to lighten the mood. "That was thoughtful."
"Yes," my dad said through clenched teeth. "Thank you, Susan."
I opened the book. Sure enough, the title page bore an inscription in my grandfather's shaky handwriting. "To Jacob Magellan Portman and the worlds he has yet to discover." I got up to leave, afraid I might start crying in front of everyone, and something slipped out from between the pages and fell to the floor. I bent to pick it up. It was a letter. Emerson. The letter. I felt the blood drain from my face. My mother leaned toward me and in a tense whisper asked if I needed a drink of water, which was mom speak for, "Keep it together, people are staring." I said, "I feel a little, and then, with one hand over my stomach, I bolted to my room. The letter was handwritten on fine, unlined paper in looping script so ornate it was almost calligraphy. the black ink varying in tone like that of an old fountain pen. It read, "Dearest Abe, I hope this note finds you safe and in the best of health. It's been such a long time since we last received word from you, but I write not to admonish, only to let you know that we still think of you often and pray for your well-being, our brave, handsome Abe. As for life on the island, little has changed, but quiet and orderly is the way we prefer things. I wonder if we would recognize you after so many years, though I'm certain you'd recognize us, those few who remain, that is. It would mean a great deal to have a recent picture of you, if you've one to send. I've included a positively ancient snap of myself. E misses you terribly. Won't you write to her? With respect and admiration, Headmistress Alma Le Fay Peregrine." As promised, the writer had enclosed an old snapshot. I held it under the glow of my desk lamp, trying to read some detail in the woman's silhouetted face, but there was none to find. The image was so strange, and yet it was nothing like my grandfather's pictures. There were no tricks here. It was just a woman smoking a pipe. It looked like Sherlock Holmes's pipe, curved and drooping from her lips. My eyes kept coming back to it. Was this what my grandfather had meant for me to find? Yes, I thought, it has to be. Not the letters of Emerson, but a letter, tucked inside Emerson's book. But who was this headmistress, this Peregrine woman? I studied the envelope for a return address, but found only a fading postmark that read, "Cairnholm Island, Cymru, UK. UK. That was Britain. I knew from studying atlases as a kid that Cymru meant Wales. Cairnholm Island had to be the island Miss Peregrine had mentioned in her letter. Could it have been the same island where my grandfather lived as a boy? 9 months ago, he told me to find the bird. 9 years ago, he had sworn that the children's home where he'd lived was protected by one, by a bird who smoked a pipe. At age 7, I'd taken this statement literally, but the headmistress in the picture was smoking a pipe, and her name was Peregrine, a kind of hawk. What if the bird my grandfather wanted me to find was actually the woman who'd rescued him, the headmistress of the children's home? Maybe she was still on the island, after all these years, old as dirt, but sustained by a few of her wards, children who'd grown up but never left. For the first time, my grandfather's last words began to make a strange kind of sense. He wanted me to go to the island and find this woman, his old headmistress. If anyone knew the secrets of his childhood, it would be her. But the envelope's postmark was 15 years old. Was it possible she was still alive? I did some quick calculations in my head. If she'd been running a children's home in 1939 and was, say, 25 at the time, then she'd be in her late 90s today. So it was possible. There were people older than that in Inglewood who still lived by themselves and drove. And even if Miss Peregrine had passed away in the time since she'd sent the letter, there might still be people on Cairnholm who could help me, people who had known Grandpa Portman as a kid. People who knew his secrets. "We," she had written. "Those few who remain." As you can imagine, convincing my parents to let me spend part of my summer on a tiny island off the coast of Wales was no easy task. They, particularly my mother, had many compelling reasons why this was a wretched idea, including the cost, the fact that I was supposed to spend the summer with Uncle Bobby learning how to run a drug empire, and that I had no one to accompany me, since neither of my parents had any interest in going, and I certainly couldn't go alone. I had no effective rebuttals, and my reason for wanting to make the trip? I think I'm supposed to. Wasn't something I could explain without sounding even crazier than they already feared I was. I certainly wasn't going to tell my parents about Grandpa Portman's last words, or the letter, or the photo. They would have had me committed. The only sane-sounding arguments I could come up with were things like, I want to learn more about our family history. And the never-persuasive, Chad Kramer and Josh Bell are going to Europe this summer. Why can't I? I brought these up as frequently as possible without seeming desperate, even once resorting to, it's not like you don't have the money, a tactic I instantly regretted, but it looked like it wasn't going to happen. Then, several things happened that helped my case enormously. First, Uncle Bobby got cold feet about my spending the summer with him, because who wants a nutcase living in their house? So my schedule was suddenly wide open. Next, my dad learned that Cairnholm Island is a super important bird habitat, and, like, half the world's population of some bird that gives him a total ornithology boner lives there. He started talking a lot about his hypothetical new bird book, and whenever the subject came up, I did my best to encourage him and sound interested. But the most important factor was Dr. Golan. After a surprisingly minimal amount of coaxing by me, he shocked us all by not only signing off on the idea, but also encouraging my parents to let me go. It could be important for him, he told my mother after a session one afternoon. It's a place that's been so mythologized by his grandfather that visiting could only serve to demystify it. He'll see that it's just as normal and unmagical as any place else, and by extension, his grandfather's fantasies will lose their power. It could be a highly effective way of combating fantasy with reality. But I thought he already didn't believe that stuff, my mother said, turning to me. Do you, Jake? I don't, I assured her. Not consciously, he doesn't, Dr. Golan said. But it's his unconscious that's causing him problems right now. The dreams, the anxiety. And you really think going there could help? My mother said, narrowing her eyes at him as if readying herself to hear the unvarnished truth. When it came to things I should or should not be doing, Dr. Golan's word was law. I do, he replied. And that was all it took. After that, things fell into place with astonishing speed. Plane tickets were bought, schedules scheduled, plans laid. My dad and I would go for 3 weeks in June. I wondered if that was too long, but he claimed he needed at least that much time to make a thorough study of the island's bird colonies. I thought Mom would object. 3 whole weeks. But the closer our trip got, the more excited for us she seemed. My two men, she would say, beaming, off on a big adventure. I found her enthusiasm kind of touching, actually, until the afternoon I overheard her talking on the phone to a friend, venting about how relieved she'd be to have her life back for 3 weeks and not have 2 needy children to worry about. I love you too, I wanted to say with as much hurtful sarcasm as I could muster, but she hadn't seen me, and I kept quiet. I did love her, of course. But mostly just because loving your mom is mandatory, not because she was someone I think I'd like very much if I met her walking down the street. Which she wouldn't be, anyway. Walking is for poor people. During the 3-week window between the end of school and the start of our trip, I did my best to verify that Ms. Alma LaFay Peregrine still resided among the living, but internet searches turned up nothing. Assuming she was still alive, I'd hoped to get her on the phone and at least warn her that I was coming, but I soon discovered that almost no one on Cairnholm even had a phone. I found only one number for the entire island, so that's the one I dialed. It took nearly a minute to connect, the line hissing and clicking, going quiet, then hissing again, so that I could feel every mile of the vast distance my call was spanning. Finally, I heard that strange European ring, wop, 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 and a man whom I could only assume was profoundly intoxicated answered the phone.
"Pisshole!"
he bellowed. There was an unholy amount of noise in the background, the kind of dull roar you'd expect at the height of a raging frat party. I tried to identify myself, but I don't think he could hear me.
"Pisshole!"
he bellowed again.
"Who's this now?"
But before I could say anything, he'd pulled the receiver away from his head to shout at someone.
"I said shut up, you dozy bastards! I'm on the..."
And then the line went dead. I sat with the receiver to my ear for a long, puzzled moment, then hung up. I didn't bother calling back. If Karen Holmes' only phone connected to some den of iniquity called the Piss Hole, how did that bode for the rest of the island? Would my first trip to Europe be spent evading drunken maniacs and watching birds evacuate their bowels on rocky beaches? Maybe so. But if it meant that I'd finally be able to put my grandfather's mystery to rest and get on with my unextraordinary life, anything I had to endure would be worth it. Chapter 3. Fog closed around us like a blindfold. When the captain announced that we were nearly there, at first I thought he was kidding. All I could see from the ferry's rolling deck was an endless curtain of gray. I clutched the rail and stared into the green waves, contemplating the fish who might be soon enjoying my breakfast, while my father stood shivering beside me in shirt sleeves. It was colder and wetter than I'd ever known June could be. I hoped, for his sake and mine, that the grueling 36 hours we'd braved to get this far, 3 airplanes, 2 layovers, shift-napping in grubby train stations, and now this interminable gut-churning ferry ride would pay off. Then my father shouted, "Look!" and I raised my head to see a towering mountain of rock emerge from the blank canvas before us. It was my grandfather's island, looming and bleak, folded in mist, guarded by a million screeching birds. It looked like some ancient fortress constructed by giants. As I gazed up at its sheer cliffs, tops disappearing in a reef of ghostly clouds, the idea that this was a magical place didn't seem so ridiculous. My nausea seemed to vanish. Dad ran around like a kid on Christmas, his eyes glued to the birds wheeling above us.
"Jacob, look at that!"
he cried, pointing to a cluster of airborne specks.
"Manx shearwaters."
As we drew nearer the cliffs, I began to notice odd shapes lurking underwater. A passing crewman caught me leaning over the rail to stare at them and said,
"Never seen a shipwreck before, eh?"
I turned to him. "Really?"
"This whole area's a nautical graveyard. It's like the old captains used to say. 'Twixt Hotland Point and Cairnholm Bay is a sailor's grave by night or day.'"
Just then we passed a wreck that was so near the surface, the outline of its greening carcass so clear that it looked like it was about to rise out of the water like a zombie from a shallow grave.
"See that one?"
he said, pointing at it.
"Sunk by a U-boat, she was."
"There were U-boats around here?"
"Loads. Whole Irish Sea was rotten with German subs. Wager you'd have half a navy on your hands if you could unsink all the ships they torpedoed."
He arched one eyebrow dramatically, then walked off laughing. I jogged along the deck to the stern, tracking the shipwreck as it disappeared beneath our wake. Then, just as I was starting to wonder if we'd need climbing gear to get onto the island, its steep cliffs sloped down to meet us. We rounded a headland to enter a rocky half-moon bay. In the distance, I saw a little harbor bobbing with colorful fishing boats, and beyond it, a town set into a green bowl of land. A patchwork of sheep-speckled fields spread across hills that rose away to meet a high ridge, where a wall of clouds stood like a cotton parapet. It was dramatic and beautiful, unlike any place I'd seen. I felt a little thrill of adventure as we chugged into the bay, as if I were sighting land where maps had noted only a sweep of undistinguished blue. The ferry docked, and we humped our bags into the little town. Upon closer inspection, I decided it was, like a lot of things, not as pretty up close as it seemed from a distance. Whitewashed cottages, quaint except for the satellite dishes sprouting from their roofs, lined a small grid of muddy gravel streets. Because Cairnholm was too distant and too inconsequential to justify the cost of running power lines from the mainland, foul-smelling diesel generators buzzed on every corner like angry wasps, harmonizing with the growl of tractors, the island's only vehicular traffic. At the edges of town, ancient-looking cottages stood abandoned and roofless, evidence of a shrinking population, children lured away from centuries-old fishing and farming traditions by more glamorous opportunities elsewhere. We dragged our stuff through town, looking for something called the Priest Home, where my dad had booked a room. I pictured an old church converted into a bed and breakfast, nothing fancy, just somewhere to sleep when we weren't watching birds or chasing down leads. We asked a few locals for directions, but got only confused looks in return. "They speak English, right?" my dad wondered aloud. Just as my hand was beginning to ache from the unreasonable weight of my suitcase, we came upon a church. We thought we'd found our accommodations until we went inside and saw that it had indeed been converted, but into a dingy little museum, not a B&B. We found the part-time curator in a room hung with old fishing nets and sheep shears. His face lit up when he saw us, then fell when he realized we were only lost. "I reckon you're after the priest hole," he said. "It's got the only rooms to let on the island." He proceeded to give us directions in a lilting accent, which I found enormously entertaining. I loved hearing Welsh people talk, even if half of what they said was incomprehensible to me. My dad thanked the man and turned to go, but he'd been so helpful, I hung back to ask him another question. "Where can we find the old children's home?" "The old what?" he said, squinting at me. For an awful moment, I was afraid we'd come to the wrong island, or, worse yet, that the home was just another thing my grandfather had invented. "It was a home for refugee kids," I said. "During the war, a big house." The man chewed his lip and regarded me doubtfully, as if deciding whether to help or to wash his hands of the whole thing. But he took pity on me. "I don't know about any refugees," he said, "but I think I know the place you mean. It's way up on the other side of the island, past the bog and through the woods. Though I wouldn't go mucking about up there alone if I was you. Stray too far from the path, and that's the last anyone'll hear of you. Nothing but wet grass and sheep paddies to keep you from going straight over a cliff."
"That's good to know," my dad said, eyeing me. "Promise me you won't go by yourself."
"All right, all right." "What's your interest in it anyhow?" the man said. "It's not exactly on the tourist maps."
"Just a little genealogy project," my father replied, lingering near the door. "My dad spent a few years there as a kid."
I could tell he was eager to avoid any mention of psychiatrists or dead grandfathers. He thanked the man again and quickly ushered me out the door. Following the curator's directions, we retraced our steps until we came to a grim-looking statue carved from black stone, a memorial called The Waiting Woman, dedicated to islanders lost at sea. She wore a pitiful expression and stood with arms outstretched in the direction of the harbor, many blocks away, but also toward the priest hole, which was directly across the street. Now, I'm no hotel connoisseur, but one glance at the weathered sign told me that our stay was unlikely to be a 4-star mince-on-your-pillow-type experience. Printed in giant script at the top was Wines, Ales, Spirits. Below that, in more modest lettering, Fine Food. Handwritten along the bottom, clearly an afterthought, was Rooms to Let, though the S had been struck out. leaving just the singular room. As we lugged our bags toward the door, my father grumbling about con men and false advertising, I glanced back at the waiting woman and wondered if she wasn't just waiting for someone to bring her a drink. We squeezed our bags through the doorway and stood blinking in the sudden gloom of a low-ceilinged pub. When my eyes had adjusted, I realized that hole was a pretty accurate description of the place. Tiny leaded windows admitted just enough light to find the beer tap without tripping over tables and chairs on the way. The tables, worn and wobbling, looked like they might be more useful as firewood. The bar was half-filled, at whatever hour of the morning it was, with men in various states of hushed intoxication, heads bowed prayerfully over tumblers of amber liquid.
"You must be after the room," said the man behind the bar, coming out to shake our hands. "I'm Kev, and these are the fellas. Say hello, fellas."
"Hello,"
they muttered, nodding at their drinks. We followed Kev up a narrow staircase to a suite of rooms, plural, that could charitably be described as basic. There were two bedrooms, the larger of which Dad claimed, and a room that tripled as a kitchen, dining room, and living room, meaning that it contained one table, one moth-eaten sofa, and one hot plate. The bathroom worked most of the time, according to Kev,
but if it ever gets dicey, there's always Old Reliable.
He directed our attention to a portable toilet in the alley out back, conveniently visible from my bedroom window.
"Oh, and you'll need these," he said, fetching a pair of oil lamps from a cabinet. "The generators stopped running at 10 since petrol's so bloody expensive to ship out, so either you get to bed early or you learn to love candles and kerosene." He grinned. "Hope it ain't too medieval for you."
We assured Kev that outhouses and kerosene would be just fine. Sounded like fun, in fact. A little adventure, yes sir. And then he led us downstairs for the final leg of our tour.
"You're welcome to take your meals here," he said, "and I expect you will, on account of there's nowhere else to eat. If you need to make a call, we got a phone box in the corner there. Sometimes there's a bit of a queue for it, though, since we get doodly for mobile reception out here, and you're looking at the only landline on the island. That's right, we got it all. Only food, only bed, only phone."
And he leaned back and laughed, long and loud. The only phone on the island. I looked over at it. It was the kind that had a door you could pull shut for privacy, like the ones you see in old movies, and realized with dawning horror that this was the Grecian orgy. This was the raging frat party I'd been connected to when I called the island a few weeks ago. This was the piss hole. Kev handed my dad the keys to our rooms.
"Any questions?" he said. "You know where to find me."
"I have a question," I said. "What's a piss? I mean, a priest hole?" The men at the bar burst into laughter.
"Why, it's a hole for priests, of course," one said,
which made the rest of them laugh even harder. Kev walked over to an uneven patch of floorboards next to the fireplace where a mangy dog lay sleeping.
"Right here,"
he said, tapping what appeared to be a door in the floor with his shoe.
"Ages ago, when just being a Catholic could get you hung from a tree, clergy folk came here seeking refuge. If Queen Elizabeth's crew of thugs come chasing after, we hid whoever needed hiding in snug little spots like this, priest holes."
It struck me the way he said "we," as if he'd known those long-dead islanders personally.
"Snug indeed,"
one of the drinkers said.
"But they were warm as toast and tight as drums down there."
"I'd take warm and snug to strung up by priest killers any day," said another.
"Hear, hear,"
the first man said.
"Took Cairn home. May she always be a rock of refuge." "To Cairn home,"
they chorused and raised their glasses together. Jet-lagged and exhausted, we went to sleep early. Or rather, we went to our beds and lay in them with pillows covering our heads to block out the thumping cacophony that issued through the floorboards, which grew so loud that at one point I thought surely the revelers had invaded my room. Then the clock must have struck 10 because all at once the buzzing generators outside sputtered and died, as did the music from downstairs and the streetlight that had been shining through my window. Suddenly, I was cocooned in silent, blissful darkness with only the whisper of distant waves to remind me where I was. For the first time in months, I fell into a deep, nightmare-free slumber. I dreamed instead about my grandfather as a boy, about his first night here, a stranger in a strange land, under a strange roof, owing his life to people who spoke a strange tongue. When I awoke, sun streaming through my window, I realized it wasn't just my grandfather's life that Miss Peregrine had saved, but mine, too, and my father's. Today, with any luck, I would finally get to thank her. I went downstairs to find my dad already bellied up to a table, slurping coffee and polishing his fancy binoculars. Just as I sat down, Kev appeared bearing two plates loaded with mystery meat and fried toast.
"I didn't know you could fry toast," I remarked,
to which Kev replied that there wasn't a food he was aware of that couldn't be improved by frying. Over breakfast, Dad and I discussed our plan for the day. It was to be a kind of scout, to familiarize ourselves with the island. We'd scope out my dad's bird-watching spots first, and then find the children's home. I scarfed my food, anxious to get started. Well fortified with grease, we left the pub and walked through town, dodging tractors and shouting to each other over the din of generators until the streets gave way to fields and the noise faded behind us. It was a crisp and blustery day, the sun hiding behind giant cloud banks only to burst out moments later and dapple the hills with spectacular rays of light, and I felt energized and hopeful. We were heading for a rocky beach where my dad had spotted a bunch of birds from the ferry. I wasn't sure how we would reach it, though. The island was slightly bowl-shaped, with hills that climbed toward its edges only to drop off at precarious seaside cliffs. But at this particular spot, the edge had been rounded off, and a path led down to a minor spit of sand along the water. We picked our way down to the beach, where what seemed to be an entire civilization of birds were flapping and screeching and fishing in tide pools. I watched my father's eyes widen. "Fascinating," he muttered, scraping at some petrified guano with the stubby end of his pen. "I'm going to need some time here. Is that all right?" I'd seen this look on his face before, and I knew exactly what "some time" meant. Hours and hours. "Then I'll go find the house by myself," I said.
"Not alone, you aren't. You promised."
"Then I'll find a person who can take me."
"Who?"
"Kev will know someone." My dad looked out to sea, where a big rusted lighthouse jutted up from a pile of rocks.
"You know what the answer would be if your mom were here," he said.
My parents had differing theories about how much parenting I required. Mom was the enforcer, always hovering, but Dad hung back a little. He thought it was important that I make my own mistakes now and then. Also, letting me go would free him to play with guano all day.
"Okay," he said, "but make sure you leave me the number of whoever you go with."
"Dad, nobody here has phones," he sighed.
"Right. Well, as long as they're reliable."
Kev was out running an errand, and because asking one of his drunken regulars to chaperone me seemed like a bad idea, I went into the nearest shop to ask someone who was at least gainfully employed. The door read, "Fishmonger." I pushed it open to find myself cowering before a bearded giant in a blood-soaked apron. He left off decapitating fish to glare at me, dripping cleaver in hand, and I vowed never again to discriminate against the intoxicated.
What the hell for?
He growled when I told him where I wanted to go.
Nothing over there but bog land and balmy weather.
I explained about my grandfather and the children's home. He frowned at me, then leaned over the counter to cast a doubtful glance at my shoes.
I suppose Dylan ain't too busy to take you,
he said, pointing his cleaver at a kid about my age who was arranging fish in a freezer case.
But you'll be wanting proper footwear. Wouldn't do to let you go in them trainers. Mud'll suck 'em right off.
Really? I said. Are you sure?
Dylan, fetch our man here a pair of Wellingtons.
The kid groaned and made a big show of slowly closing the freezer case and cleaning his hands before slouching over to a wall of shelves packed with dry goods.
Just so happens we've got some good sturdy boots on offer,
the fishmonger said.
Buy one, get none free.
He burst out laughing and slammed his cleaver on a salmon, its head shooting across the blood-slick counter to land perfectly in a little guillotine bucket. I fished the emergency money Dad had given me from my pocket, figuring that a little extortion was a small price to pay to find the woman I'd crossed the Atlantic to meet. I left the shop wearing a pair of rubber boots so large my sneakers fit inside, and so heavy it was difficult to keep up with my begrudging guide. So, do you go to school on the island? I asked Dylan, scurrying to catch up. I was genuinely curious. What was living here like for someone my age? He muttered the name of a town on the mainland. What is that, an hour each way by ferry?
Yup.
And that was it. He responded to further attempts at conversation with even fewer syllables, which is to say, none. So finally, I just gave up and followed him. On the way out of town, we ran into one of his friends, an older boy wearing a blinding yellow tracksuit and fake gold chains. He couldn't have looked more out of place on Cairnholm if he'd been dressed like an astronaut. He gave Dylan a fist bump and introduced himself as Worm.
Worm?
It's his stage name, Dylan explained.
We're the sickest rapping duo in Wales, Worm said. I'm MC Worm, and this is the Sturgeon Surgeon, a.k.a. MC Dirty Dylan, a.k.a. MC Dirty Business, Cairnholm's number one beatboxer. Wanna show this yank how we do it, Dirty D?
Dylan looked annoyed.
Now,
drop some next-level beats, son.
Dylan rolled his eyes, but did as he was asked. At first, I thought he was choking on his tongue, except there was a rhythm to his sputtering coughs.
Puh-puh-cha, puh-puh-puh-cha,
over which Worm began to rap.
I likes to get wrecked up and down at the priest hole. Your dad's always there 'cause he's on the dole. My rhymes is tight, yet I make it look easy. Dylan's beats are hot like chicken Jalfrezi.
Dylan stopped.
That don't even make sense, he said.
And it's your dad who's on the dole. Oh, shit! Dirty D, let the beat drop!
Worm started beatboxing while doing a passable robot, his sneakers twisting holes in the gravel.
Take the mic, D!
Dylan seemed embarrassed, but let the rhymes fly anyway.
I met a tight bird and her name was Sharon. She was keen on my tracksuit and the trainers I was wearing. I showed her the time like Doctor Who. I thunk up this rhyme while I was in the loo.
Worm shook his head.
The loo? I wasn't ready.
They turned to me and asked what I thought. Considering that they didn't even like each other's rapping, I wasn't sure what to say. I guess I'm more into music with, like, singing and guitars and stuff. Worm dismissed me with a wave of his hand.
He wouldn't know a dope rhyme if it bit him in the bollocks, he muttered.
Dylan laughed, and they exchanged a series of complex, multi-stage handshake fist bump high fives. Can we go now? I said. They grumbled and dawdled a while longer, but pretty soon we were on our way, this time with Worm tagging along. I took up the rear, trying to figure out what I would say to Miss Peregrine when I met her. I was expecting to be introduced to a proper Welsh lady and sip tea in the parlor and make polite small talk until the time seemed right to break the bad news. "I'm Abraham Portman's grandson," I would say. "I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but he's been taken from us." Then, once she'd finished quietly dabbing away tears, I would ply her with questions. I followed Dylan and Worm along a path that wound through pastures of grazing sheep before a lung-busting ascent up a ridge. At the top hovered an embankment of rolling, snaking fog so dense it was like stepping into another world. It was truly biblical. A fog I could imagine God, in one of his lesser wraths, cursing the Egyptians with. As we descended the other side, it only seemed to thicken. The sun faded to a pale white bloom. Moisture clung to everything, beating on my skin and dampening my clothes. The temperature dropped. I lost Worm and Dylan for a moment, and then the path flattened, and I came upon them just standing, waiting for me.
"Yank boy," Dylan called. "This way."
I followed obediently. We abandoned the path to plow through a field of marshy grass. Sheep stared at us with big, leaky eyes, their wool soggy and tails drooping. A small house appeared out of the mist. It was all boarded up.
"You sure this is it?" I said. "It looks empty."
"Empty? No way. There's loads of shit in there,"
Worm replied.
"Go on,"
Dylan said.
"Have a look."
I had a feeling it was a trick, but stepped up to the door and knocked anyway. It was unlatched and opened a little at my touch. It was too dark to see inside, so I took a step through and, to my surprise, down into what looked like a dirt floor, but I quickly realized was in fact a shin-deep ocean of excrement. This tenantless hovel, so innocent-looking from the outside, was really a makeshift sheep stable, quite literally a shithole.
"Oh my God!"
I squealed in disgust. Peals of laughter exploded from outside. I stumbled backward through the door before the smell could knock me unconscious and found the boys doubled over, holding their stomachs.
"You guys are assholes," I said, stomping the muck off my boots.
"Why?" said Worm. "We told you it was full of shit."
I got in Dylan's face. "Are you going to show me the house or not?"
"He's serious," said Worm, wiping tears from his eyes.
"Of course I'm serious."
Dylan's smile faded.
"I thought you were taking a piss, mate."
"Taking a what?"
"Joking, like."
"Well, I wasn't."
The boys exchanged an uneasy look. Dylan whispered something to Worm. Worm whispered something back. Finally, Dylan turned and pointed up the path.
"If you really want to see it," he said, "keep going past the bog and through the woods. It's a big old place. You can't miss it."
"What the hell? You're supposed to go with me."
Worm looked away and said,
"This is as far as we go."
"Why?"
"It just is."
And they turned and began to trudge back the way we'd come, receding into the fog. I weighed my options. I could tuck tail and follow my tormentors back to town, or I could go ahead alone and lie to Dad about it. After 4 seconds of intense deliberation, I was on my way. A vast lunar bog stretched away into the mist from either side of the path, just brown grass and tea-colored water as far as I could see, featureless, but for the occasional mound of piled-up stones. It ended abruptly at a forest of skeletal trees, branches spindling up like the tips of wet paintbrushes, and for a while, the path became so lost beneath fallen trunks and carpets of ivy that navigating it was a matter of faith. I wondered how an elderly person like Miss Peregrine would ever be able to negotiate such an obstacle course. She must get deliveries, I thought, though the path looked like it hadn't seen a footprint in months, if not years. I scrambled over a giant trunk slick with moss, and the path took a sharp turn. The trees parted like a curtain, and suddenly, there it was, cloaked in fog, looming atop a weed-choked hill. The house. I understood at once why the boys had refused to come. My grandfather had described it 100 times, but in his stories, the house was always a bright, happy place. Big and rambling, yes, but full of light and laughter. What stood before me now was no refuge from monsters, but a monster itself, staring down from its perch on the hill with vacant hunger. Trees burst forth from broken windows, and skins of scabrous vine gnawed at the walls like antibodies attacking a virus, as if nature itself had waged war against it. But the house seemed unkillable, resolutely upright despite the wrongness of its angles and the jagged teeth of sky visible through sections of collapsed roof. I tried to convince myself that it was possible someone could still live there, run down as it was. Such things weren't unheard of where I came from, a falling down wreck on the edge of town, curtains permanently drawn that would turn out to have been home to some ancient recluse who'd been surviving on ramen and toenail clippings since time immemorial, though no one realizes it until a property appraiser or an overly ambitious census taker barges in to find the poor soul returning to dust in a lazy boy. People get too old to care for a place. Their family writes them off for one reason or another. It's sad, but it happens, which meant, like it or not, that I was going to have to knock. I gathered what scrawny courage I had and waded through waist-high weeds to the porch, all broken tile and rotting wood, to peek through a cracked window. All I could make out through the smeared glass were the outlines of furniture, so I knocked on the door and stood back to wait in the eerie silence, tracing the shape of Miss Peregrine's letter in my pocket. I'd taken it along in case I needed to prove who I was, but as a minute ticked by, then two, it seemed less and less likely that I would need it. Climbing down into the yard, I circled the house looking for another way in, taking the measure of the place, but it seemed almost without measure, as though with every corner I turned, the house sprouted new balconies and turrets and chimneys. Then I came around back and saw my opportunity, a doorless doorway, bearded with vines, gaping and black, an open mouth just waiting to swallow me. Just looking at it made my skin crawl, but I hadn't come halfway around the world just to run away screaming at the sight of a scary house. I thought of all the horrors Grandpa Portman had faced in his life and felt my resolve harden. If there was anyone to find inside, I would find them. I mounted the crumbling steps and crossed the threshold. Standing in a tomb-dark hallway just inside the door, I stared frozenly at what looked for all the world like skins hanging from hooks. After a queasy moment in which I imagined some twisted cannibal leaping from the shadows with knife in hand, I realized they were only coats rotted to rags and green with age. I shuddered involuntarily and took a deep breath. I'd only explored 10 feet of the house and was already about to foul my underwear. "Keep it together," I told myself, and then slowly moved forward, heart hammering in my chest. Each room was a disaster more incredible than the last. Newspapers gathered in drifts. Scattered toys, evidence of children long gone, lay skinned in dust. Creeping mold had turned window-adjacent walls black and furry. Fireplaces were throttled with vines that had descended from the roof and begun to spread across the floors like alien tentacles. The kitchen was a science experiment gone terribly wrong. Entire shelves of jarred food had exploded from 60 seasons of freezing and thawing, splattering the wall with evil-looking stains, and fallen plaster lay so thickly over the dining room floor that for a moment I thought it had snowed indoors. At the end of a light-starved corridor, I tested my weight on a rickety staircase, my boots leaving fresh tracks and layers of dust. The steps groaned, as if woken from a long sleep. If anyone was upstairs, they'd been there a very long time. Finally, I came upon a pair of rooms missing entire walls, into which a little forest of underbrush and stunted trees had grown. I stood in the sudden breeze, wondering what could possibly have done that kind of damage, and began to get the feeling that something terrible had happened here. I couldn't square my grandfather's idyllic stories with this nightmare house, nor the idea that he'd found refuge here with the sense of disaster that pervaded it. There was more left to explore, but suddenly it seemed like a waste of time. It was impossible that anyone could still be living here, even the most misanthropic recluse. I left the house feeling like I was further than ever from the truth. Chapter 4. Once I'd hopped and tripped and felt my way like a blind man through the woods in fog and re-emerged into the world of sun and light, I was surprised to find the sun sinking and the light going red. Somehow the whole day had slipped away. At the pub, my dad was waiting for me, a black-as-night beer and his open laptop on the table in front of him. I sat down and swiped his beer before he'd had a chance to even look up from typing. "Oh, my sweet Lord," I sputtered, choking down a mouthful. "What is this, fermented motor oil?" "Just about," he said, laughing, and then snatched it back. "It's not like American beer. Not that you'd know what that tastes like, right?" "Absolutely not," I said with a wink, even though it was true. My dad liked to believe I was as popular and adventuresome as he was at my age, a myth it had always seemed easiest to perpetuate. I underwent a brief interrogation about how I'd gotten to the house and who'd taken me there, and because the easiest kind of lying is when you leave things out of the story rather than make them up, I passed with flying colors. I conveniently forgot to mention that Worm and Dylan had tricked me into wading through sheep excrement and then bailed out a half mile from our destination. Dad seemed pleased that I'd already managed to meet a couple kids my own age. I guess I also forgot to mention the part about them hating me. "So how was the house?"
"Trashed."
He winced.
"Guess it's been a long time since your grandpa lived there, huh?"
"Yeah, or anyone." He closed the laptop, a sure sign I was about to receive his full attention.
"I can see you're disappointed."
"Well, I didn't come thousands of miles looking for a house full of creepy garbage."
"So what are you going to do?"
"Find people to talk to. Someone will know what happened to the kids who used to live there. I figure a few of them must still be alive, on the mainland if not around here, in a nursing home or something."
"Sure, that's an idea."
He didn't sound convinced, though. There was an odd pause, and then he said,
"So do you feel like you're starting to get a better handle on who your grandpa was, being here?"
I thought about it. "I don't know. I guess so. It's just an island, you know?"
He nodded. "Exactly."
"What about you?"
"Me?"
He shrugged.
"I gave up trying to understand my father a long time ago."
"That's sad. Weren't you interested?"
"Sure I was. Then, after a while, I wasn't anymore."
I could feel the conversation going in a direction I wasn't entirely comfortable with, but I persisted anyway.
"Why not?"
"When someone won't let you in, eventually you stop knocking. Know what I mean?" He hardly ever talked like this. Maybe it was the beer, or that we were so far from home. Or maybe he decided I was finally old enough to hear this stuff. Whatever the reason, I didn't want him to stop.
"But he was your dad. How could you just give up?"
"It wasn't me who gave up," he said a little too loudly, then looked down, embarrassed, and swirled the beer in his glass.
"It's just that, the truth is, I think your grandpa didn't know how to be a dad. But he felt like he had to be one anyway, because none of his brothers or sisters survived the war. So he dealt with it by being gone all the time, on hunting trips, business trips, you name it. And even when he was around, it was like he wasn't." Is this about that one Halloween? What are you talking about?
You know, from the picture.
It was an old story, and it went like this. It was Halloween. My dad was 4 or 5 years old and had never been trick-or-treating, and Grandpa Portman had promised to take him when he got off work. My grandmother had bought my dad this ridiculous pink bunny costume, and he put it on and sat by the driveway waiting for Grandpa Portman to come home from 5 o'clock until nightfall, but he never did. Grandma was so mad that she took a picture of my dad crying in the street just so she could show my grandfather what a huge asshole he was. Needless to say, that picture has long been an object of legend among members of my family and a great embarrassment to my father.
It was a lot more than just one Halloween, he grumbled.
Really, Jake, you were closer to him than I ever was. I don't know. There was just something unspoken between the two of you.
I didn't know how to respond. Was he jealous of me?
Why are you telling me this?
Because you're my son, and I don't want you to get hurt.
Hurt how?
He paused. Outside, the clouds shifted, the last rays of daylight throwing our shadows against the wall. I got a sick feeling in my stomach, like when your parents are about to tell you they're splitting up, but you know it before they even open their mouths.
I never dug too deep with your grandpa because I was afraid of what I'd find, he said finally.
You mean about the war?
No. Your grandpa kept those secrets because they were painful. I understood that. I mean about the traveling, him being gone all the time. What he was really doing. I think, your aunt and I both thought, that there was another woman. Maybe more than one.
I let it hang between us for a moment. My face tingled strangely.
That's crazy, Dad.
We found a letter once. It was from a woman whose name we didn't know, addressed to your grandfather. I love you. I miss you. When are you coming back? That kind of thing. Seedy, lipstick on the collar type stuff. I'll never forget it. I felt a hot stab of shame, like somehow it was my own crime he was describing, and yet I couldn't quite believe it.
We tore up the letter and flushed it down the toilet. Never found another one either. Guess he was more careful after that.
I didn't know what to say. I couldn't look at my father.
I'm sorry, Jake. This must be hard to hear. I know how much you worshipped him.
He reached out to squeeze my shoulder, but I shrugged him off, then scraped back my chair and stood up.
I don't worship anyone.
Okay, I didn't want you to be surprised, that's all.
I grabbed my jacket and slung it over my shoulder.
What are you doing? Dinner's on the way.
You're wrong about him, I said, and I'm going to prove it.
He sighed. It was a letting go kind of sigh.
Okay, I hope you do.
I slammed out of the priest hole and started walking, heading nowhere in particular. Sometimes you just need to go through a door. It was true, of course, what my dad had said. I did worship my grandfather. There were things about him that I needed to be true, and his being an adulterer was not one of them. When I was a kid, Grandpa Portman's fantastic stories meant it was possible to live a magical life. Even after I stopped believing them, there was still something magical about my grandfather. To have endured all the horrors he did, to have seen the worst of humanity and have your life made unrecognizable by it, to come out of all that the honorable and good and brave person I knew him to be, that was magical. So I couldn't believe he was a liar and a cheater and a bad father, because if Grandpa Portman wasn't honorable and good, I wasn't sure anyone could be. The museum's doors were open, and its lights were on, but no one seemed to be inside. I'd gone there to find the curator, hoping he knew a thing or two about the island's history and people, and could shed some light on the empty house and the whereabouts of its former inhabitants. Figuring he'd just stepped out for a minute, the crowds weren't exactly kicking down his door, I wandered into the sanctuary to kill time checking out museum displays. The exhibits, such as they were arranged in big open-fronted cabinets that lined the walls and stood where pews had once been. For the most part, they were unspeakably boring, all about life in a traditional fishing village and the enduring mysteries of animal husbandry, but one exhibit stood out from the rest. It was in a place of honor at the front of the room, in a fancy case that rested atop what had been the altar. It lived behind a rope I stepped over, and a little warning sign I didn't bother to read, and its case had polished wooden sides and a plexiglass top so that you could only see into it from above. When I looked inside, I think I actually gasped, and for one panicky second thought, "Monster!" because I had suddenly and unexpectedly come face to face with a blackened corpse. Its shrunken body bore an uncanny resemblance to the creatures that had haunted my dreams, as did the color of its flesh, which was like something that had been spit-roasted over a flame. But when the body failed to come alive and scar my mind forever by breaking the glass and going for my jugular, my initial panic subsided. It was just a museum display, albeit an excessively morbid one. "I see you've met the old man," called a voice from behind me, and I turned to see the curator striding in my direction. "You handled it pretty well. I've seen grown men faint dead away." He grinned and reached out to shake my hand. "Martin Paget, don't believe I caught your name the other day." "Jacob Portman," I said. "Who's this, Wales' most famous murder victim?"
"Ha! Well, he might be that too, though I never thought of him that way. He's our island's senior most resident, better known in archaeological circles as Cairnholm Man, though to us, he's just the old man. More than 2,700 years old, to be exact, though he was only 16 when he died. So he's rather a young old man, really."
2,700? I said, glancing at the dead boy's face, his delicate features somehow perfectly preserved. "But he looks so..."
"That's what happens when you spend your golden years in a place where oxygen and bacteria can't exist, like the underside of our bog. It's a regular fountain of youth down there, provided you're already dead, that is."
"That's where you found him? The bog?"
He laughed. "Not me. Turf cutters did, digging for peat by the big stone cairn out there, back in the 70s.
He looked so fresh, they thought there might be a killer loose on Cairnholm, till the cops had a look at the Stone Age bow in his hand and the noose of human hair around his neck. They don't make 'em like that anymore."
I shuddered. "Sounds like a human sacrifice or something."
"Exactly. He was done in by a combination of strangulation, drowning, disembowelment, and a blow to the head.
Seems rather like overkill, don't you think?"
"I guess so."
Martin roared with laughter.
"He guesses so."
"Okay, yeah, it does."
"Sure it does. But the really fascinating thing, to us modern folk anyway, is that in all likelihood the boy went to his death willingly, eagerly even. His people believe that bogs, and our bog in particular, were entrances to the world of the gods, and so the perfect place to offer up their most precious gift, themselves."
"That's insane."
"I suppose, though I imagine we're killing ourselves right now in all manner of ways that'll seem insane to people in the future. And as doors to the next world go, a bog ain't a bad choice.
It's not quite water, and it's not quite land. It's an in-between place."
He bent over the case, studying the figure inside. "Ain't he beautiful?" I looked at the body again, throttled and flayed and drowned, and somehow made immortal in the process.
"I don't think so," I said.
Martin straightened, then began to speak in a grandiose tone.
"Come you, and gaze upon the tar man. Blackly he reposes, tender face the color of soot, withered limbs like veins of coal, feet lumps of driftwood hung with shriveled grapes."
He threw his arms out like a hammy stage actor and began to strut around the case.
Come, you, and bear witness to the cruel art of his wounds, pearled and meandering lines drawn by knives, brain and bone exposed by stones, the rope still digging at his throat. First fruit slashed and dumped, seeker of heaven, old man arrested in youth, I almost love you.
He took a theatrical bow as I applauded.
Wow, I said. Did you write that? Guilty, he replied with a sheepish smile. I twiddle about with lines of verse now and then, but it's only a hobby. In any case, thank you for indulging me.
I wondered what this odd, well-spoken man was doing on Cairnholm, with his pleated slacks and half-baked poems, looking more like a bank manager than someone who lived on a windswept island with one phone and no paved roads.
Now, I'd be happy to show you the rest of my collection, he said, escorting me toward the door, but I'm afraid it's shutting up time. If you'd like to come back tomorrow, however...
Actually, I was hoping you might know something, I said, stopping him before he could shoo me out. It's about the house I mentioned this morning. I went to see it.
Well, he exclaimed, I thought I'd scared you off it. How's our haunted mansion faring these days? Still standing?
I assured him that it was, then got right to the point. The people that live there, do you have any idea what happened to them?
They're dead, he replied. Happened a long time ago.
I was surprised, though I probably shouldn't have been. Miss Peregrine was old. Old people die, but that didn't mean my search was over. I'm looking for anyone else who might have lived there too, not just the headmistress.
All dead, he repeated. No one's lived there since the war.
That took me a moment to process. What do you mean? What war?
When we say the war, around here, my boy, there's only one that we mean, the second. It was a German air raid that got him, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that can't be right. He nodded. In those days, there was an anti-aircraft gun battery at the far tip of the island, past the wood where the house is. It made Cairnholm a legitimate military target. Not that legitimate mattered much to the Germans, one way or another, mind you. Anyway, one of the bombs went off track, and, well, he shook his head. Nasty luck.
That can't be right, I said again, though I was starting to wonder. Why don't you sit down and let me fix you some tea, he said. You look a bit off the mark.
Just feeling a little lightheaded. He led me to a chair in his office and went to make the tea. I tried to collect my thoughts. Bombed in the war. That would certainly explain those rooms with blown-out walls. But what about the letter from Miss Peregrine? Postmarked Cairnholm. Sent just 15 years ago. Martin returned, handing me a mug.
There's a nip of Penderin in it, he said. Secret recipe, you know. Should get you sorted in no time.
I thanked him and took a sip, realizing too late that the secret ingredient was high-test whiskey. It felt like napalm flushing down my esophagus.
It does have a certain kick, I admitted, my face going red.
He frowned.
Reckon I ought to fetch your father.
No, no, I'll be fine. But if there's anything else you can tell me about the attack, I'd be grateful. Martin settled into a chair opposite me.
About that, I'm curious. You say your grandfather lived here. He never mentioned it?
I'm curious about that too, I said. I guess it must have been after his time. Did it happen late in the war or early?
I'm ashamed to admit I don't know. But if you're keen, I can introduce you to someone who does. My Uncle Augie. He's 83, lived here his whole life, still sharp as a tack.
Martin glanced at his watch.
If we catch him before Father Ted comes on the telly, I'm sure he'd be more than happy to tell you anything you like.
10 minutes later, Martin and I were wedged deep in an overstuffed sofa in Augie's living room, which was piled high with books and boxes of worn-out shoes and enough lamps to light up Carl's bad caverns, all but one of them unplugged. Living on a remote island, I was starting to realize, turned people into pack rats. Augie sat facing us in a threadbare blazer and pajama bottoms, as if he'd been expecting company, just not pants-worthy company, and rocked endlessly in a plastic-covered easy chair as he talked. He seemed happy to have an audience, and after he'd gone on at length about the weather and Welsh politics and the sorry state of today's youth, Martin was finally able to steer him around to the attack and the children from the home.
"Sure, I remember them," he said. "Odd collection of people. We'd see them in town now and again, the children. Sometimes they're minder women, too, buying milk and medicine and what have you. You'd say, 'Good morning,' and they'd look the other way. Kept to themselves, they did, off in that big house. Lot of talk about what might have been going on over there, though no one knew for sure."
"What kind of talk?"
"Lot of rot. Like I said, no one knew. All I can say is they weren't your regular sort of orphan children. Not like them Bernardo home kids they got in other places, who you'll see come into town for parades and things, and always have time for a chat. This lot was different. Some of them couldn't even speak the King's English, or any English for that matter."
"Because they weren't really orphans," I said. "They were refugees from other countries. Poland, Austria, Czechoslovakia."
"Is that what they were now?"
Augie said, cocking an eyebrow at me.
"Funny, I hadn't heard that."
He seemed offended, like I'd insulted him by pretending to know more about his island than he did. His chair rocking got faster, more aggressive. If this was the kind of reception my grandpa and the other kids got on Cairnholm, I thought, no wonder they kept to themselves. Martin cleared his throat.
"So, Uncle, the bombing?"
"Oh, keep your hair on. Yes, yes, the goddamn cherries. Who could forget them?"
He launched into a long-winded description of what life on the island was like under threat of German air raids. The blaring sirens, the panic scrambles for shelter, the volunteer air raid warden who ran from house to house at night, making sure shades had been drawn and streetlights were put out to rob enemy pilots of easy targets. They prepared as best they could, but never really thought they'd get hit, given all the ports and factories on the mainland, all much more important targets than Cairnholm's little gun emplacement. But one night, the bombs began to fall.
"The noise was dreadful," Augie said. "It was like giants stamping across the island, and it seemed to go on for ages. They gave us a hell of a pounding, though no one in town was killed, thank heaven. Can't say the same for our gunner boys, though they gave as good as they got, nor the poor souls at the orphan home. One bomb was all it took. Gave up their lives for Britain, they did. So wherever they was from, God bless 'em for that."
"Do you remember when it happened?" I asked. "Early in the war or late?"
"I can tell you the exact day," he said. "It was the 3rd of September, 1940.
The air seemed to go out of the room. I flashed to my grandfather's ashen face, his lips just barely moving, uttering those very words. "September 3rd, 1940. "Are you sure about that? That it was that day?"
"I never got to fight," he said. "Too young by a year. That one night was my whole war. So yes, I'm sure."
I felt numb, disconnected. It was too strange. Was someone playing a joke on me, I wondered? A weird, unfunny joke?
"And there weren't any survivors at all?" Martin asked.
The old man thought for a moment, his gaze drifting up to the ceiling.
Now that you mention it, he said, I reckon there were just one, a young man, not much older than this boy here.
His rocking stopped as he remembered it.
Walked into town the morning after with not a scratch upon him. Hardly seemed perturbed at all, considering he'd just seen all his mates go to their reward. It was the queerest thing.
He was probably in shock, Martin said.
I shouldn't wonder, replied Augie. He spoke only once, to ask my father when the next boat was leaving for the mainland. Said he wanted to take up arms directly and kill the damned monsters who murdered his people.
Augie's story was nearly as far-fetched as the ones Grandpa Portman used to tell, and yet I had no reason to doubt him. I knew him, I said. He was my grandfather. They looked at me, astonished.
Well, Augie said, I'll be blessed.
I excused myself and stood up. Martin, remarking that I seemed out of sorts, offered to walk me back to the pub, but I declined. I needed to be alone with my thoughts. Come and see me soon, then, he said, and I promised I would.